Well, we're looking at Hebrews chapter 11, and this is week number 3 on this chapter. And we've seen that this chapter is all about faith. The writer was writing to help Christians who were struggling and finding it hard to keep going. And so, to encourage them, he reminds them of a whole string of people who lived in Old Testament times, people who pressed on through all sorts of difficulties, people who carried on worshipping God and serving God, whatever the odds against them. Some of these people achieved great things, and he talks about their great achievements. Some of them suffered terrible things, and he talks about their sufferings. But the thing that was true of them all was that they persevered. They kept going, whatever difficulties they faced. And in the end, each one of them lived a life that pleased God. God was able to commend each one of them. And the writer asks, well, what was their secret? What motivated them? What kept them going? And his answer is, they lived by faith. And so he's saying to his readers and to us, you've got to have the same faith that they had. That's the only thing that can keep you going. If you want to achieve anything worthwhile with your life, if you want to achieve anything for God, if you want to survive as a Christian when the pressure is on, if you want to complete the race, then what you need is faith. A faith that's living and strong and active and that grows stronger as the pressures become stronger. And so he gives us these great examples of Old Testament believers who lived by faith. And he says, you can be like them. They're there to set us an example. They're there to encourage us. They're there to inspire us. Now, I think it's worth clarifying at this point what we mean by that. What we mean when we say that these people are supposed to be examples for us. In what sense these people are to be examples for us? I guess it's something that's just built into the human psyche, that we all have people whom we think of as examples to follow, people we admire, people who we think of as our heroes, people we want to be like. And that can be a very good thing for us. That can be an inspirational thing for us. I've let our youngsters watch a couple of films recently. They don't watch many, but I've let them watch recently a couple of films about different people. Eric Liddell, that amazing Scottish athlete who refused to run on a Sunday because he knew he had to keep the Sabbath holy for God. And he resisted all the pressure that was put on him, and he stuck to his principles. He forfeited the Olympic medal that he was tipped to win. But instead he ran in another race that wasn't really his event, and he won the gold. And he did it all with such charm and with such self-effacing humility and with such sportsmanship. Well, I want my children to admire someone like that. That's why I encourage them to watch that film. I want them to be inspired by Liddell's dynamism and determination, as well as by his devotion to the Lord. I think it'll do them good if they model themselves on Eric Liddell. And then they've just watched a film about Douglas Bader, the flying ace who lost both his legs in a crash. You know that name? Still managed to talk his way back into the RAF when the Second War began and became one of our key leaders in the Battle of Britain. It's another story of astonishing determination against the odds. And Bader had huge gifts as a leader, as a flying man. And once he decided what he was going to do, he didn't allow anything to stop him. And again, I think that'll do my children good, to have someone like that as a role model. So I think it can be very good for us to have personal heroes. It can be a great motivator. It can be a great encouragement. The only thing is that it can also be a great discouragement. Because, of course, we can't always achieve what our heroes achieved. And we can finish up comparing ourselves with them and just feeling despair. You know, one of my lads could watch a film about Eric Liddell and decide that he's going to be a great athlete. But the fact is that almost certainly he won't have Eric Liddell's physical gifts. And if he makes it his great ambition to win an Olympic gold, he's likely to be disappointed, isn't he? Or he could become fascinated by Doug Bader, and he'll decide that he's going to be an inspirational wartime leader. And he'll apply to join the RAF, and then he'll be turned down, because we're reducing our armed forces. I want my children to admire people like Liddell and Bader without trying to be them. Without assuming that what they're going to do with their life is what those men did. And that's the thing when you read a list like the one we've got here in Hebrews 11. There are all sorts of different people in the list. People who lived at different times. People who were in different situations. People who faced different challenges. People who had different gifts. Some of them were amazingly gifted people. Someone like Samson was awesome, just in terms of physical strength. Some of them had miraculous powers. As the writer says, there were people in this list who were used to raise the dead. Some of them were put in absolutely unique, unrepeatable situations. You know, there's only one man who's ever been asked to keep the whole human race safe and the whole animal kingdom through a year when the whole earth was one giant disaster zone. There's never going to be another Noah. Some of them had unique privileges, unique opportunities. Moses was brought up in a palace where he was a member of the Egyptian royal family. If I really imagine I'm going to be another Samson, that I'm going to be as gifted as he was, then I'm likely to be totally frustrated, aren't I? Totally disappointed. If I think I'm going to be allowed access to Her Majesty the Queen in order to order her around the way that Moses ordered Pharaoh around, then I'm almost certainly going to find it doesn't happen. Moses only got that because of his unique upbringing. Most believers aren't given that sort of access to royalty, are we? If I think I'm going to raise the dead, if I'm going to try to do it like Elijah, well, I'm going to finish up with egg on my face. That sort of miracle was for a particular situation, a particular point in history. It was unique. If I think I'm going to be another Noah and rescue the whole world, I'm living in cloud cuckoo land. When we say that we're going to imitate these heroes of faith, that's not what it means. That we're going to achieve the things they achieved by faith. It doesn't mean that we're going to have lives like theirs. It doesn't mean we're going to have the same gifts as they had, or be placed in the situations they were placed in, or have the same opportunities that they were given. Doesn't matter how much faith you have, you're still not going to be Noah. You're still not going to be Samson. When we say that we are to imitate these people, take them as our examples, what it means is that we've got to live by the same faith that they lived by. I can't imitate Samson's gifts and achievements, and I'm not asked to. I can't imitate Joseph in the way that he became the most powerful man in the whole country. I'm not told to. I'm not going to be a Moses preaching to millions of people. Boy, what a voice he must have had, incidentally, to make himself heard by all Israel in the wilderness. I've not got David's poetic skills and musical skills. And I'm never in this world going to sit on a throne ruling a whole nation. I've got to live my Christian life as who I am. A married man in his 50s with four young children, living on a council estate in the suburbs of Stockport, pastoring a congregation of 30 people, having no extraordinary gifts, no miraculous gifts, no great influence, no status. I've got to live that life by faith. And that's what God is looking for. Not for me to be another Samson or another Moses or another David. He's looking for me to live by faith in my situation, with my personality, doing the work he's given me to do. And likewise for you, if you're a Christian. Don't read this chapter and say, by faith I can be Noah. Or by faith I can be Deborah. And don't read this chapter and say, I can't be a Noah. I can't be a Deborah. I can't lead God's people in a time of crisis. I can't play a public role like Joseph. So this chapter isn't for me. Don't read this chapter and say, this is all irrelevant for me. I'm not even available like the people who marched around Jericho. I'm stuck at home with my children. You're not supposed to be imitating the gifts or the achievements or the work that these people did. You're supposed to be imitating their faith. And what does that mean? Let's say it again. What is faith? Faith is being sure that what God has promised for the future, he will do, and living accordingly. Faith is being sure of what we hope for. And faith is being confident that there are unseen realities which are more important in the long run than the things you can see, the things you can touch, and living on that basis. Faith is being certain of what we don't see. Faith means living on the basis that there's another world, a future world, an eternal world, and that world is more important than this world. It's more important to have the blessings of that world than to have anything in this world. And faith means believing, really believing, that there's an invisible realm all around us, that God exists, that he's real, really real, that he's all powerful, and that he loves his children, and that he's for us. It means really believing that he's active through his invisible angels, that he's working out his invisible plans, that his invisible spirit really is in me and in the church and in you if you're a Christian. Faith means that you really believe those things and that you act as if you believe them, that you make them the basis for all your decisions. I'm living for the future. That's what the man of faith says, the woman of faith. I'm living to get eternal blessings. I'm living determined to win everlasting joys. And I'm living for the invisible. I fear the invisible God more than I fear anything in this world. I serve the invisible God rather than serving the people of this world. I love the invisible God more than I love anyone or anything I can see. I trust the invisible God instead of trusting the things that other people say are solid and secure. That's faith. And it doesn't matter what your personality is. It doesn't matter what gifts you've been given or not given. It doesn't matter what situation or circumstances you've been put in. If you're a Christian, you live your life by faith. you're a single mum, bringing up your children, having to do three part-time jobs to survive, then you live by faith. You live thinking about the world to come, about how you prepare yourself and your children for that world. You live remembering in every crisis that there's an unseen God whom you must honour and trust. If you're a businessman working in a frenetic, competitive, high-pressure environment, well, then you live by faith. You remind yourself constantly that it's more important to lay up treasure in heaven than it is to get the contracts you want on earth. You go into every business meeting with a consciousness that the unseen God is present, that he's watching, that he's listening, that he's holding your hand. If you're a sixth form student trying to decide what courses you're going to follow, what applications you're going to put in, you say again and again and again, I'm not just trying to equip myself for life on this earth. I'm trying to work out what will bring me most reward in the everlasting world to come. I'm not thinking first about the people around me who want to advise me and who tell me what they think is sensible. I'm thinking first about what my invisible God would tell me is wise. Do you see, faith isn't just for great warriors like some of the warriors in this chapter, or for preachers, or for miracle workers, or for great martyrs who are called to suffer and die in persecution times. Faith is the secret of every Christian's life. Faith is what steers us through every day, in the home, or in the place of work, or in the neighbourhood, in every situation. Our obsession with the future world and with the unseen God. That's what we're called to imitate here in this chapter. Samson isn't in this list because he had fantastic strength. He's here because when it came to the crisis, he believed that the future and the invisible were all important. Moses isn't here because he was used to do miracles, to part the Red Sea. He's here because he thought that the invisible God was more important than the king of Egypt sitting on his throne. What does it say? It says these were all commended for their faith. Doing miracles, having astonishing gifts, having fantastic opportunities. You can't arrange those things for yourself. And having faith won't guarantee you those things. But there is this faith. The faith which means that you spend your time thinking about the joys and blessings of the world to come. And you remind yourself constantly of the unseen God and his unseen power and his unseen love. And you decide that you are going to put future things and unseen things first all the time. Okay, last week we looked at the first great example of faith in this chapter. Adam's son, Abel, he worshipped God by faith. And we thought last week about how Abel showed his faith by the sacrifice that he brought to God. That was chapter 11, verse 4. The second example that the writer gives us of faith, verse 5, Enoch. Enoch walked with God by faith. Verse 5, by faith Enoch was taken from this life, so that he did not experience death. He could not be found, because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. We know so little about Enoch. The writer of Genesis tells us so little about Enoch. The whole story of Enoch in the book of Genesis is only half a dozen verses. This is Genesis chapter 5, verse 18. When Jared had lived 162 years, he became the father of Enoch. And after he became the father of Enoch, Jared lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. And altogether, Jared lived 962 years and then he died. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. And after he became the father of Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enoch lived 365 years. Enoch walked with God. Then he was no more, because God took him away. That's it. That's all we know for sure about Enoch. We know he was born. We know he had a son called Methuselah, and then other sons and daughters. We know he was taken from this world. God, it seems, just removed him alive. And we know that during the time he was in this world, he walked with God. We're not told about any great work he did. We're not told of anything amazing that he achieved. We're not told that he suffered terribly. We're not told that he led any great movements. We're not told he wrote any significant books. We're just told he walked with God. And that brings home, doesn't it, what I've been saying and this morning, that faith doesn't have to mean having great achievements, living your life on a big stage, being hugely gifted, suffering heroically as a martyr. As far as we know, Enoch didn't do any of those things. If he did, the writer of Genesis doesn't think it's worth mentioning them. What mattered about this man was that he walked with God. The God he couldn't see. The invisible God. This man thought of God as his ever-present companion. Everywhere he went, he was conscious that God was walking next to him. God was real to this man. When he talked to other people, he was aware that God was listening. When he carried out his business, whatever his business might have been, he was aware that God was silently watching every transaction. Whenever he and his children were in a room together, he remembered that God was there too. He lived his whole life with the thought, I'm in the presence of God. And that's what he wanted. He wanted the presence of the invisible God. It's not just that God came to him. It says he walked with God. He actively walked with God. He wanted to be where God was. He didn't go anywhere where he didn't think God would want to go. And wherever he thought God would want to go, Enoch was willing to go with him. He knew that to walk with God, he would have to do without the things that God doesn't like. And he knew that to walk with God, he would have to choose the things that God does like. It's obvious, isn't it? Walking with God is only possible for a person who wants to please God. There's a verse in the book of Amos which says, how can two people walk together unless they're agreed? That's true, isn't it? If two people are walking together and one of them is determined to do things that the other one hates, then they're going to part company. Person A hates walking in the sunshine. Person B hates walking in the shade. Person A loves to smoke while he strolls. Person B hates the smell of cigarettes. Person A likes to stop and stare into every shop window. Person B likes to hurry along. They're going to part company. They're not going to walk together. God isn't going to walk with someone who's acting and talking in a way that God hates. Well, Enoch has settled it in his mind. I want to walk with God. And I want God walking with me. So that means God and I have got to be friends. I've got to live my life in a way that pleases God. I've got to avoid the things that God hates. I've got to choose the things that God loves. I want to have God's presence all the time. That's more important to me than anything this world holds. I want to have the presence of God, though I can't see him. So I will only do the things that please God. I'll never talk in a way that would offend him. I'll always talk about the things that he loves to hear me talking about. Enoch was living to please the invisible God. Now that's faith. It's amazing. It really is amazing when you see it. It's amazing especially when you consider the place and the time when Enoch was living. Because though we don't know much about Enoch, we know a lot about the society he was living in. The writer of Genesis describes how after Adam and Eve sinned against God, with each generation their descendants became more and more openly wicked, and the world became a darker and more horrible place. The very first generation, you've got Cain killing his brother Abel. But then 5 generations on from Cain, his descendant Lamech is boasting about the fact that he's more violent and savage, more bloodthirsty than Cain ever was. He's abandoned God's pattern for marriage, taken 2 wives, and then he boasts to those wives about how he's going to kill anyone who touches him. He's going to exact vengeance 7-fold for any harm done to him. He's already killed a young man, he boasts, for touching him. And from that point on, things just get worse and worse. Until finally you get this in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 5. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of man's heart was only evil all the time. And the Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth. His heart was filled with pain. The earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. And God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on earth had corrupted their ways. That's what the world became. A world dominated totally by violence and brutality. A world where people just grabbed whatever they could and just struck out at anyone who stood in their way. A world where the vulnerable were crushed and the powerful and trod them down. And that's what led to the flood. The world was in such a mess that God said, we're going to have to start again. And he destroyed the whole human race apart from Noah and his family. After the flood, God put checks in place to make sure that the human race never degenerated to that stage of wickedness again. Well, we've seen some horrible, some evil societies in the world since then. We've seen cruel societies, chaotic, brutal societies, whether it's Nero's Rome or Hitler's Germany or Stalin's Russia or Pol Pot's Cambodia. There are things, when you read about those societies or anti-societies, you just shudder with horror, you shake with fear. There have been some times when society has come close to total collapse into anarchy. Yugoslavia maybe after the fall of communism. But there's never been a society like the society that existed before the flood. Never before or since was there ever a society given over so totally to corruption, to godlessness, to violence. All flesh on earth had corrupted its way. That's the story that Genesis tells. We know Enoch wasn't here in this world at the very end, just before the flood, when things had reached the point of total collapse. God took Enoch away before that point. But Enoch had to live through the build-up to that.
Enoch had to live in a society that was heading towards the abyss. A society where people were abandoning all moral restraints. A society that was collapsing into total wickedness. And Enoch walked with God. Isn't that amazing? Isn't it astonishing what faith enabled Enoch to do? That in that collapsing society, where the whole human race was throwing off the thought of God, and where it seemed that God was forgetting the whole human race, isn't it amazing that there was one man who was conscious of God all the time? One man who was walking steadily with God. One man who enjoyed God's presence. One man whose only interest was pleasing God. It's hard to imagine the pressure he was under, isn't it? People must have thought Enoch was mad. You can only imagine the sneers, the insults that he endured as he walked with God. Oh, here's Enoch again with his imaginary friend. You can imagine how people tried to corrupt him, tried to drag him down to their level, tried to get him involved in the debauchery and the sick things that they were involved in, how they wanted Enoch to accept their values, how they threatened him. You can imagine how some of them will have tried to intimidate him and frighten him, how they'll have harassed him, or worse than harass him. And through it all, he walked on with God. The invisible God, more real to him, more important to him than all the people he could see around him. The people who were laughing, the people who were bullying him, the people who were threatening his children maybe. Enoch really believed that the reward at the end of the day that he would gain from walking with God was worth more than the approval of all the people around him. Walking with God, knowing God, was worth more than the wealth that other people were piling up through their crimes. Enoch just kept walking steadily, concerned only with that one thing: am I pleasing God? Can I trust this God to reward me? You know, we sometimes think it's hard walking with God in our society, don't we? Because we feel that our society is collapsing. We feel that the corruption is piling up. Hard to maintain any consciousness of God, isn't it? When you're surrounded by people who ignore his existence. When everyone talks as if he doesn't exist. When everybody's living for this world. When everyone assumes that this world is all that matters. It's hard to stay aware of God all the time. It's hard to keep that vivid sense, God is real. God is here. God really loves me. It's hard to keep believing that his word is simply the truth. It's hard to remember that this world is just a passing shadow. That it's the world to come that's the real world, the solid world. It's hard to keep in our minds the burning certainty. God is, and he rewards those who seek him with all their hearts. And there's an eternity of reward beyond all imagination. The one moment in that world is bigger, more significant than everything this world has to offer. It outweighs it all. Hard to live like that, isn't it? Hard not to be corrupted by the influence of this world. Because it's all around us, crowding in on us all the time. You know, in our society, you can't escape, can you? You can't escape from the propaganda of the world and the ugly, vile things that the world wants to pump into our minds. can't escape from the media. You can't escape from the junk mail that pours through your letterbox, offering you unmissable opportunities. You can't escape from the advertising. You can't escape from the sordid things, the display of lewd magazines in the newsagent, the crude lyrics of the music that's played, Ada, round the supermarket. I suppose you could retire to a small holding in the Hebrides if you want to, and grow all your own produce. But otherwise you've got to go to the shops, and you're going to be hammered there by the total atmosphere. Your children are going to stare at the Halloween displays with all that's crude and sick about them. Is it possible? Is it possible to maintain that vivid consciousness of God and His purity and His holiness in a society like this? Is it possible just to walk steadily, happily with God, delighting in His friendship, in His companionship? Is it possible to keep your mind pure, to have heavenly values here and now? Well, Enoch did. And he was living in a harder society than ours. And Enoch brought up his children in that society. We're not told very much about Enoch's son, Methuselah, but we're told about Enoch's grandson, who was evidently a believer, hanging on to the promises of God. And we're told about Enoch's great-grandson, Noah. This man, Enoch, not only kept his own godliness, but he kept godliness within his family. He walked with God and others wanted to follow him. His grandson wanted to follow him where he walked. That's faith. Just walking with God. Go down to whatever Christian bookshop there may be, and you will find rows of Christian bestsellers about Christians who lived by faith. And they're all sensational. Stories about people who by faith did sensational things, transformed the world. That's not Enoch's story. Enoch just walked with God. That's the challenge for you. Will you walk with God today? When you go home from this place, will you be walking with God? When you go into the place where you work tomorrow, will you walk with God? When you go shopping, will you walk with God? Will you be walking with that consciousness? God is. And He's more important, more real than anything in this world. And His rewards are worth having, even if it means losing this whole world to have them. Will you walk with God? It's a challenge for me. As I say, we're not called to imitate the details of the lives of these people in Hebrews 11. We're not called to live the lives they lived in their situations. But there is one life. One life that you must study. One life that you must seek to live out. When the writer has told us the stories of all these men and women of Old Testament times, remember again the words with which he concludes, "Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the forerunner and the completer of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross." Do you want to see what it really means to walk with God? Then read the Gospels again and see there Jesus, conscious of his Father all the time, loving his Father all the time, trusting his Father all the time, pushing aside the things that were on offer for him in this world and setting his eyes on what the Father had planned for him, a cross at Calvary, believing that everlasting rewards were more important than all that this world holds for the joy set before him. He endured the cross. It's the Spirit of Jesus in our hearts, the Holy Spirit, who can give to us that faith, the faith in which the Lord Jesus himself lived. Fix your eyes on him.